pleasure to be here at PI and on this stage in particular. So the emphasis today will be on Wilson loops, and the framework is that of causal dynamical triangulations, familiar to some, but maybe not to all of you. So what is the larger context of what I'm going to talk about today? Well, it's really the all-important question of finding observables in non-perturbative quantum gravity. And more specifically, what I'm interested in today is an observable that captures the notion of curvature in the context of the quantum theory. So one way of phrasing it, the question is as follows. Is there a meaningful notion of curvature on very short scales, so the Planck scale, characteristic for quantum phenomena, which on large scales becomes the curvature of general relativity? So I want a notion of curvature, and I don't a priori know what it is going to be at the Planck scale because I have very large fluctuations. I want at least some quantity that's finite and such that, you know, when I take a suitable large scale limit, it becomes something I recognize as standard curvature or part of curvature of GR. So let me start by noting that popular observables, of course, of which we have very, very few, that people have picked up, and we've also investigated extensively in causal dynamical triangulations. So things like the spectral or the Hausdorff dimension of space, which you could even call pre-geometric in the sense that they tell you something about the dimension of the space, but not yet too much about its metric structure. They involve length and volumes, but if one adopts a metric language, not derivatives of the metric. Yeah? So these are things that one has relatively easily access to. But of course, if you're talking about curvature, we are thinking of, you know, second order differential expressions in terms of the metric tensor in a metric formulation. Now, this is not to say that there are no notion of curvature, no notions of curvature in things in this discretized gravity framework, so like quadratic calculus and dynamical triangulations, because there is, for instance, a very simple way of writing the scalar curvature that goes back to Regge. And of course, the scalar curvature you need just when you want to write down the Einstein-Hilbert action in terms of such variables. But the problem with this expression, this naive expression, is that when you take a continuum limit, as you inevitably want to do in the kind of approach I'm talking about, then this curvature is basically of the form of a sum over deficit angles. So when you take a continuum limit, then these deficit angles, they become dense in your, in your sum, even when you keep, you know, look just as a finite piece of space-time. So these expressions diverge very badly, and we don't know yet of a very good way to regularize and renormalize them so that they would, you know, become good candidates for such a curvature observable. Now comes the idea, of course, which is not exactly new. Could Wilson loop type observables provide us with coarse-grained measures of curvature, whereby coarse-grained, we mean, well, things that maybe don't necessarily see, you know, Planckian or sub-Planckian wiggles of space-time, but somehow average in a natural way over some larger sets of points. And of course, Wilson loops themselves are, of course, one-dimensional objects. So they're already kind of, you could say, smeared out in one dimension. So this is basically kind of the background to what I want, the motivation to what I'm going to talk about today. And it's based on a paper I wrote with Jan here in the audience, Andrzej Görlich and Jerzy Jukiewicz from Krakow that appeared last month on the archive and is hopefully also going to appear in print in published form soon. Okay. Now, a motivation for invoking Wilson loops when trying to learn something about curvature, of course, comes from gauge field theory. Yeah? So especially in non-abelian gauge field theory, one is looking for gauge invariant quantities. And a non-local and gauge invariant observable in gauge field theory of this kind is obtained by taking the trace of a certain quantity, which I call the path ordered exponential, of the gauge potential, a mu, along a closed curve gamma. And one obtains a so-called Wilson loop, or Wilson loop observable, so which I call W. Gamma denotes the dependence on a closed curve in space-time. A is just the gauge potential. And what one does is one integrates kind of a one-form gauge potential around a one-dimensional closed object. So that is kind of a natural duality. So roughly speaking, that gives you then something that's algebra valued. You exponentiate it, you get something that's group valued, and well, you take the trace, and then you just get a number. Yeah. And because A, in general, will just take values in a non-abelian, non-commutative algebra, you need to put this path ordering prescription here, which ensures you that kind of the A arguments that appear, if you imagine that, say, expanded in powers of A, they are ordered along the path. And of course, if you change the ordering, this object would be different. So this object without the trace, I'll refer to as holonomy. Well, people use various, in math and physics, there's various types of expressions that denote holonomies, but this is what I'll mean. So this object without the trace, and then you get this path-ordered object. And what's the connection with curvature? If I imagine a very particular loop, an infinitesimal square loop that just spans a little piece of in the mu new plane, yeah, then if I evaluate this object, this path-ordered exponential, in powers of the edge length of this squared, let me call the edge length epsilon, then I get the following expression. It starts with a 1. So of course, this is group valued. So this is the unit matrix of the group, whatever SUN group you might be talking about. And in the first non-trivial contribution, epsilon squared contribution, you find the F mu, so the curvature exactly of this gauge potential up here. So this gives me information about local curvature. And of course, the Wilson loop, of course, also appears prominently in QCD as a confinement criterion. That is, if the expectation value of this Wilson loop here, of a specific Wilson loop, I mean, running through kind of Euclidean spacetime, if that exponentially scales with the area that's enclosed, kind of minimal area enclosed by the loop, gamma, so e to the minus some constant times this area, that's called the area law, and that's a believed to be a signal of confinement in QCD. But what I will primarily be interested in is, of course, is local information, so local field information, not global topological information, as I would be if I was talking about 2+1 gravity, say. Then, of course, I'd be interested, people talk about Wilson loops, as capturing the global modes of the metric. But that's not what I want to do primarily. I want to understand local modes, local curvature primarily. Okay, so that brings us to the context of gravity. So also there, just in simple metric gravity, there is a connection form floating around, the Levi-Civita connection, gamma mu nu k. And I can use this to construct the analogs of holonomies and also of Wilson loops. And we are well familiar, just from classical general relativity, of the geometric interpretation that has, namely, this path-ordered exponential of this gamma just defines a notion of parallel transport of vectors, of tangent vectors. I'll get to this in a little more detail later on. Moreover, you can also show that in Riemannian geometry, all gauge, information, gauge invariant information that is in the Riemann curvature tensor can be retrieved from just looking at holonomies, at infinitesimal holonomies locally. Yeah. So somehow, so all the interesting physical information is actually in these variables. In distinction to what happens in gauge theory, the Wilson loops, although they are gauge invariant in the sense of, you know, rotations of the local frames, they're not actually diffeomorphism invariant objects because they depend on one-dimensional objects, loops or open paths. Yeah, and they would, these will in principle transform in some way under diffeos. There have been very little studied as far as space-time Wilson loops are concerned. The one of exception is the body of work by Modanese in perturbative quantum gravity from the first half of the 90s. So there's a whole series of papers. One of them is actually called Wilson loops in gravity. But his analysis is a perturbative study on flat background. And it's in no way, unfortunately, generalizes in terms of the what one does computationally with these objects to the non-perturbative context I'm interested in. There have been attempts to study Wilson loops in quantum magic calculus, and there's a couple of papers by Humber and Williams from a few years ago. And in part, our study was motivated by what they are trying to do. And that's really what I said on my first slide, trying to understand how Wilson loop could capture curvature information. But I don't think these papers are yet there. We are also not yet there, as I'll explain, but there are nuances of difference with what they do and what we do. Okay, now of course, talking here about Wilson loops in gravity, there's of course a big elephant in the room, which is canonical quantum gravity in the form of loop quantum gravity. The loops one talks about there, however, of course, are spatial loops. And the idea of loop quantum gravity is really to use variables of Wilson loop type to rewrite all of quantum gravity in. So that's just the big program of loop quantum gravity. And of course, it has evolved a little bit over the years. But that's the essential idea. Yeah. In spirit, of course, looking at it in a somewhat larger context, it's very reminiscent of what people tried to do back in the 80s in non-Abelian gauge field theory, namely also to reformulate that theory purely in terms of these gauge invariant objects, these Wilson loops. Yeah? So you do away with field strengths, with gauge potentials, but rewrite everything in terms of these nice, because gauge invariant quantities. So this is, I mean, this is associated with names of Migdal, Marquet, and co. So they had a program to rewrite the dynamics of QCD in terms of these objects. Now, ultimately, this never took off. What's the reason why it didn't? Well, one can write down dynamical equations for these objects, but they don't behave in a nice way under renormalization. So one doesn't have nice renormalized equations of motion. One can do anything with, or one can solve. So somehow this program, yeah, never led anywhere particular in four dimensions. What I'll talk about today is much, much less radical than either this or that program. I will just simply use, you know, my formulation of gravity, of quantum gravity, and I look at Wilson loops only as specific examples of observables. And so my dynamical context within which I look at these, try to define and then also measure some of these objects is that of causal dynamical triangulations. And that's, of course, a path integral approach to gravity. And well, based on pure geometry, pure in the sense of there not being coordinates around. What I do on the next couple of slides, I'll just give a lightning summary of CDT, in as much as I needed to explain what the ingredients are in my construction of Wilson loops and how I get to do the computations I'm doing. But this will be very short, and also, of course, many of you are familiar with the idea. So what's the essential logic behind quantum gravity from causal dynamic triangulations? Well, it's a non-perturbative implementation of the gravitational path integral. So that's this formal object. I've written it just for pure gravity. I could also add matter, but I won't, well, apart from, you know, at the end of my talk, I won't really need it. So this is the object, you know, defining kind of the sum over history, so-called. So it's a formal integration over all space-times, where already I'm thinking of these as the physical objects where I factored out any invariances, like the diffeomorphism invariance. And so I do this formal integral, and each of the curved space-times I'm integrating over, I weigh with a complex weight that's e to the I times the Einstein-Hilbert action, depending on that geometry little g. And this object depends on constants. In my case, it will depend on Newton's constant Gn and the cosmological constant. And this is, of course, an extremely ill-defined object. So what we're doing, very much in the spirit of lattice quantum field theory, we regularize this object. And so we throw in a bunch of regulators. And as we are then interested in the behavior of this object in this concrete implementation, regularized implementation, as we remove the regulators. And in my case, I will describe my the curved spacetimes as triangulations. This formal integral will become a sum over inequivalent triangulations, which are building from certain building blocks, triangular building blocks. They come with a length assignment, little a, and that little a has a form, is therefore has plays a role of a UV cutoff. And of course, I put many building blocks together to create kind of curved spaces, in this case, a piecewise flat curved spaces. And I take that number also to infinity. So in this double limit, I'm interested in what happens to the right-hand side and to what extent it can, in a suitable limit, where I also may, of course, have to tune, to renormalize my couplings, this leads to a can lead to a description of quantum gravity. So this is a very simple prescription here on the right. So I have just an implementation of the Einstein-Hilbert action in my weights. And the only other thing that appears here is a factor 1 over C of t. T stands for triangulation. And a C of t is just the order of the automorphism group of the triangulation. So if that t happens to have some symmetries, then one, the weight is less than 1 of the geometry. But it is, of course, for large geometries, almost always equal to 1. OK, so what are the key properties of this approach? And what are the ingredients? Just as a reminder, so there are very few ingredients this uses or priors. So what I assume to be correct is the quantum superposition principle, if you like. So this is just a way of saying I'm using a path integral. And of course, I'm sticking in some kind of local action at the bare level. And what I also put in is a causal structure. So the way I glue my building blocks knows about light cones. So this is not Euclidean quantum gravity. This also involves a notion of proper time, as you know. So because I usually glue these things in layers together. So there is a natural notion of proper time that I can identify with the substructure of my triangulations. But there is a quite extended study I've done together with Jordan in 2+1 dimensions, where we showed explicitly that apparently this can be relaxed in the sense that one puts in local causality, but one gives up the distinguished notion of proper time while preserving the kind of main results of the approach. Now, I have also Wick rotation. So the Wick rotation applies to these individual piecewise flat geometries, and it maps Lorentzian such objects onto Euclidean objects with, and simultaneously ensures that the weights become real Boltzmann weights. And it's important because in higher dimensions, I need to use Monte Carlo simulations in order to understand this big sum, this big path integral. Otherwise, I just use, you know, standard tools from quantum field theory and, of course, and also standard quantum theory. So I'm not in the school of people who want to change quantum theory just because we're talking about gravity. Okay, so the configuration space I'm using is also very conservative or old-fashioned, you might say. So it's a very straightforward discretization, regularization of the space of smooth geometries of classical GR. So instead of having these smooth curved geometries, I represent these by piecewise flat objects. And these are my triangulations. So a little piece like appears here in this illustration. And as I'll also recap later, curvature sits then in the way I glue these objects together. After I've done the microtation, I have a statistical model of geometry. So I can just, I treat it as a statistical model. I have a phase space, so that characterizes how this ensemble of objects behave as a function of the parameters I put in. So again, prominently, there's the lambda, the cosmological constant, which we fine-tune, however, and there's G Newton, and there's another a delta and anisotropy parameter that makes an appearance in the non-perturbative regime of the theory. What is very nice is that although it's a discretization, we don't think of it as a fundamental discretization, so it has nothing to do with a Planck scale cutoff. So we are taking a continuum limit where certainly our edge lengths are imagined to become either zero or at least very much smaller than the Planck length. And in this limit, you look for universal properties, so like you would do in a statistical model. So properties that then, well, if you do everything right, and if your system has a second order phase transition, many of the elements and of the arbitrary regularization details that appeared in this approach will just be washed out. And of course, it's very nice in principle something a property to have because it will contribute to the uniqueness of the outcome, if there is an interesting outcome, if you do find something that looks like a nice theory of quantum gravity. And what is very important, I keep emphasizing wherever I go, is that we have non-perturbative computational tools to actually say something about, to evaluate this path integral and to look at certain observables and say what they are quantitatively with error bars, of course, because you're using a computational and mostly Monte Carlo tools to address it. Okay, so why does this approach matter? Well, here's my one-liner. So it's as simple as it can be, but not simpler. That's, of course, stolen from somewhere else. So in part, this is, of course, a hope, is as simple as it can be, but not simpler. In part, it's also empirical. For example, what might be simpler might is the model when I take out causality as a, as a requirement for my building blocks, how I glue my building blocks together. If I remove that, I don't seem to be getting anything sensible. So apparently, that's a condition I have to put in. So don't make things too simple because then you might lose structure, which we apparently cannot regain or doesn't re-emerge, once we get the dynamics going. So this approach has come quite a long way. Of course, it has also not been totally easy because simple doesn't mean simple computations or simple interpretation of the results. But most recently, we found second order phase transitions in this model that's unprecedented for this four-dimensional geometrical model. And we've started studying implementing renormalization group flows in the vicinity, trying to understand in the vicinity of this phase transition what the physics might be. And that's, in a way, a proof of principle that this is indeed possible in the absence of a background metric. But this is nothing what I'm going to talk about today. So what's also kind of implicit in what I said earlier, the framework is very explicit. So you do their concrete calculations, you do their quantitative results you obtain, and so it's in principle falsifiable if you have some observable or something you're measuring or extracting computationally that doesn't agree with what you expect your quantum gravity theory to do or your classical limit to do, then the thing is just wrong. So therefore, this approach might actually tell you what quantum gravity is, exhibiting universal properties. which of course might be obtained by other methods, but well, that has to be shown. Now, what I'm using today is the fact that this framework, you know, we've set up is really a perfect testbed for implementing and measuring any kind of observables that you think can play a role in describing quantum gravity. And what I'm focusing about are observables involving Wilson loops today. There are objections that were thrown at us even before you, by various people, even before we started looking at this in more detail, saying, well, hang on, I mean, you're claiming CDT quantum gravity is just coordinate free, but to describe Wilson loops, you need local frames, you know, so how can you at all describe these objects in your framework? Yeah. Secondly, we are using, I should have said in passing, our building blocks are all the same. So we have just one, or in fact, because of Lorentzian structure, two types of building blocks. So it's like building two-dimensional curved surfaces from a single type of triangle. Yeah. So this means also, for the purposes of talking about curvature, whenever I talk about deficit angles, they only come in discrete units, and the units are rather big. Yeah. So and then you could worry that you get very strong discretization effects because you never have very small deficit angles. And I'll address, of course, my what I talk about will address these concerns and answer them to some extent. Yes?
So you mentioned there's only three parameters in your
yes.
definition. So yes. How do you tune into this critical point, this second phase transition?
Yes, we tune.
You need those parameters to be fixed, or?
Well, the cosmological constant is, I said it's fine-tuned, but what we actually do, we fix the space-time volume. So this parameter is not there. Then we have a phase diagram that's spent by two parameters. One of them is Newton's constant, and another one is this anisotropy parameter. And in order to go to the second order line, I have to fine-tune these parameters. So it's a line of second-order phase transition in a two-dimensional phase diagram. I have still one, I mean, along the line, I still have a parameter I can tune. And the physics of the theory, you know, of these fixed points could depend, of course, on the value of that parameter still. Yeah. It's part of this story. But, you know, again, it's quite explicit. So I have, you know, we have this phase diagram. And it's very interesting that it's very, very difficult, well, to measure near this phase transition. So that's, of course, that's where all the physics is going to be, but it's very difficult also to find observables to characterize exactly what's happening there. So again, this comes back to the theme, you know, Wilson loops are one type of observables. Can we use them to characterize, you know, what happens with geometry? Also, of course, in the vicinity of the phase transition. Okay, so, you know, everyone in this room knows very well everything about classical GR, so let me just zoom through what holonomies in gravity are all about. So given a Riemannian manifold, M with some metric G mu nu, I don't actually think it has to be, it can also have Lorentzian signature, I think this works just as well. So of course you have the metric compatible connection, capital gamma, and that defines a parallel transport of a vector. So here, we recognize this path-ordered object again. And what I'm looking at is a situation where I have just a piece of path in space, Riemannian space, or some space-time, depending on some path parameter lambda. I have here initially just a vector in the tangent space at the point xi. And, well, kind of applying this object, this path-ordered integral of the Levi-Civita connection, I'll obtain some other vector in the tangent space at the point xf, the final point. Yeah. So generally speaking, yeah, this will be just some linear transformation. So the gamma I'm integrating over here, I made everything very explicit. Now, how does this thing behave under coordinate transformation? Let me zoom in only on the dependence on the initial and the final point. Yeah? So this object, of course, has tangent space indices. Yeah? And what happens when I change coordinate system from the x to the x tilde is that I'll pick up this matrix of coordinate transformations, yeah? Which I call m mu nu. So this still transforms in a non-trivial way. And if I look at this object, it will transform both at the initial and at the final point, you know, depending how this m evaluates in these points, xi, x initial, and x final. So in this way, so in this adjoint manner. Now, generally speaking, of course, my manifold will not be covered by a single coordinate chart, but by a bunch of coordinate charts. So in every coordinate chart, gamma will look different. There will be different coordinates. So how do I now compute the holonomy if my curve runs through several of these coordinate charts? It's pretty straightforward. So what you have to do, here's your curve, just cover it with patches that overlap and choose in each of the overlaps just one arbitrary point along the curve at which you transform the, make the transformation from one coordinate system to the next. Yeah, so yeah, here you have u1 with some coordinates x1, and same for u2, u3, u4, etc. So what you simply have to do is, well, pick some point. Yeah, so compute the path ordered exponential between here and here in the coordinate system u1. Do the coordinate transformation to the next, the coordinates of the next patch, and then continue doing the path ordered integration along the curve in this way. Yeah. And so what you get is simply, you know, just a piece computed in U1, a transition matrix, which are called M, if you remember from the previous place, and then just put these two things, these things together. So let me already consider the case where Xi is actually equal to X final. So I have a closed curve, you know, which I'm covering by these coordinate patches. So the holonomy around this closed curve is then just given as I've written it here. So I alternate between a piece, you know, here from xi to x mid 1, path ordered exponential. Then I insert coordinate transformation, the matrix on the frame. And then I do the next piece of holonomy computation and so forth. So what I get is an object that still transforms only at the endpoints. And since I've now chosen xi equal to xf, there's now the same matrix that appears here on the right, the inverse, and on the left. Yeah, so it's again just the frame transformation. Now, why is that relevant? Well, what we're doing, we're now looking at not smooth geometries, curved geometries, but at piecewise flat geometries. So, and of course, in each of these triangles, I can choose a coordinate system. Yeah, so I'm in the same situation in a way. You know, when my path runs somewhere around my triangulation, I will have to change coordinate system, you know, from, you know, from triangle to triangle or from simplex to simplex. Yeah. So, and each, so that's in any dimension, in D dimensions, you get your elementary building block is a D simplex. And although, say, in neither regular calculus nor in dynamical triangulations, you have to put coordinates on these objects for most of the calculations, you know, one does, say, in evaluating these path integrals, here we, at an intermediate stage, do need to introduce coordinates. But it will just turn out that the choice one makes will drop out at the end. So it will be completely irrelevant how we do this. Yeah. So what one has is, by definition, building blocks that are flat on the interior. So that is what one means by piecewise flat. And of course, these have the property that if this is just now a two-dimensional, you know, toy example to illustrate what the situation is, if inside a flat building block, I look at a closed curve and look at its holonomy, of course, it's flat, so the Riemann tensor vanishes identically. And for any closed path that stays entirely within a building block, the power of the exponential will be just the unit matrix. Yeah, nothing happens. So rephrasing this, now I'm interested in loops that run through a bunch of such simplices. It doesn't matter at all if within a given building block I deform a curve, because when r is equal to zero, the thing doesn't depend on the shape of the curve. So without loss of generality, I can just choose a specific type of curves. And the, what I adopt as a convention is I just look at curves that run from between centers of neighboring building blocks. So here for the triangles, yeah, I let them go through the centers of the triangles and let them just hop along straight lines from one to the next. So I'm not losing any information about the curvature of these objects by choosing these particular piecewise straight paths. And I said, well, you know, anticipating what will happen, how I choose my coordinate systems on these flat building blocks will not matter in the end at all. So I can just as well make a convenient choice. I'll tell you a little later. I will just choose Cartesian coordinate frames where the metric is constant. And in a way, well, it's the same for every building block. Yeah. Now, if the metric is constant in a building block, of course, that means even more for my piece of holonomy I compute in the building block. It just will be, well, gamma will be zero. And therefore, the contribution I get from the holonomy will just be the identity matrix. Therefore, whatever, you know, the matrices are multiplied together, like in the continuum, the only thing that remains is the contribution from transitioning from one building block to the next building block. So it's something you can associate with what I call here the phase between the building blocks. Rather, it's just a transition matrix that accounts for the change of coordinate system from here to the next building block. So what my holonomies are just a bunch of transition matrices. Whenever I cross from one simplex to the next, I pick up a matrix. And because I've chosen, my building blocks are basically all the same, flat. They all have the same kind of Cartesian coordinate system. So the only thing that can happen is that these coordinate systems are rotated relative to each other. And in four dimensions, if I now think of a Euclideanized framework where my triangulations have a remaining piecewise flat structure, they can only lie in SO4. Or if I don't specify an orientation in O4, but this is kind of the maximum that can happen. And what happens when I take a closed curve? Well, I just get a bunch of these and I just multiply them, matrix multiplication. And that's what my holonomies are. Okay, now, again, you know, it's all about parallel transport and how vectors behave under parallel transport. We said in the continuum, and the very same thing is true in a piecewise flat context. There is a residual symmetry on the holonomies, which are called RL of a closed lattice loop, and it's just a change of frame in this, wherever the, you know, the lattice loop started and ended in that simplex. So it's just, I call this now capital lambda. I called it M before in the continuum. But you still have the same residual coordinate freedom that expresses itself in this transformation law. Because, and that was an inverse before, but we have already said this is an orthogonal matrix. So the inverse is the same as the transpose. Now, how do I extract information that is no longer dependent on this coordinate choice? Well, for example, as follows. So here is the schematically the lattice loop along which I'm parallel transporting the vector. So the vector was a tangent vector to the simplex, you know, that lived in the simplex I started with. I took it around by parallel transport in the way I described on the previous slide. It ends up to be some vector VL. And of course, because, well, this was length preserving for the vector, all that could have happened is just a relative rotation between the initial and the final vector. If I take their scalar product, yeah, I get an angle and a normalized, and I normalize like I do here. And this theta VVL is no longer dependent on this coordinate choice of this first simplex. And that brings us to, well, how is now curvature captured by these Wilson loops, yeah, in this piecewise flat framework? Well, as I said before, it's really, it has all to do with deficit angles. Huh? What does it look like in concrete terms? Now, ragged calculus is just now the name I give to describing curved spacetimes for any signature and any dimension by gluing together triangles. You know, so that's what ragged calculus is. And what is well known is that the curvature is located at hinges in a kind of delta function-like way. How does that work? Well, in two dimensions, yeah, imagine you're gluing together flat triangles, yeah, even just Euclidean space. Now, if you, so let's imagine this is a building block, it's just an equilateral Euclidean triangle of a certain edge length. Now, if I glue together five of these objects, of course, you know, the angles are all 60 degrees. Now, at this vertex, things don't add up to 360 degrees. There is a deficit angle. How can I extract this deficit angle? The deficit angle is, of course, an expression of curvature, of Gaussian curvature, intrinsic Gaussian curvature of this two-dimensional piece of space. I can extract it by letting, by parallel transporting a tangent vector, a two-dimensional tangent vector, around what I call kind of a minimal loop. So a loop that encircles this curvature singularity. And this red dot is kind of this hinge, which I talk about here. In higher dimension, it turns out in these triangulations that the curvature is always concentrated in D, on D minus two-dimensional simplices, subsimplices. So in three dimensions, it's located, it's concentrated along one-dimensional edges or links. So here you see actually it's quite easy to visualize still in three dimensions. You see a bunch of tetrahedra that are glued around a common link. Yeah? And so the curvature is all concentrated along here. Inside these building blocks, everything's flat. But if I parallel transport a vector around this link on a minimal loop, again, this blue line, I'll pick up exactly kind of the curvature associated with the singularity. In four dimensions, it's again exactly the same game. It's much more difficult to draw. Here, you would talk about a hinge where the curvature is concentrated. That is a triangle. That is like here, we have a bunch of tetrahedra that share the central link. There is now a bunch of four simplices that goes around, if you like, in a circle around this curvature singularity. And they share this triangle. And again, curvature is concentrated along this object. But you can, again, by parallel transporting vectors along a minimal loop around this L of T, you can extract it. So one has to be only slightly careful with these objects when one, you know, compares with the continuum formulation, because of the presence of these singularities, there is no single coordinate patch that covers this entire, say, the, you know, the interior of this diamond thing. And same here, you know, there is no coordinate patch, nice Euclidean coordinate patch that will cover, that go will go around kind of the singularity and contain the singularity. That's not possible. So you have, if you look at the four simplices that share the singularity, the most you can do is to align the coordinate systems in the way that they just share the two directions that span this curvature singularity. So to rephrase what I just said, you can ask what happens to a vector in four dimensions when I parallel transport it around this triangle-shaped, two-dimensional singular hinge. Well, if the vector runs parallel to this singularity, then nothing happens. Yeah? And since these two directions, they will be shared by all the four simplices that share it, and that's a well-defined statement. Yeah? However, to any vector that is perpendicular to these two directions, in whichever of the, you know, four simplices you look at that surround this hinge, the V will be rotated to some other vector. Yeah? And of course, in order to go from here to here, the only thing, you know, that could have been at work is some SO2 subgroup of SO4. Yeah? So this is exactly what you pick up when you go around such a minimal hinge. And if you want to extract an angle, a number associated with that, you just do the same. You just take the scalar product, the normalized scalar product of the vector before and after the parallel transport around this minimal link. So, and again, so it's a single angle that characterizes curvature. So, and that corresponds then, going back to the two-dimensional picture, that's where the name deficit angle comes from. I said before, imagine these are all equilateral. Then, of course, one way to exhibit kind of the missing angle is to kind of think of cutting this up and flattening it out on a flat, on the surface of a table or something. And you see that kind of an angle epsilon is missing to 2 pi. And this is exactly the same epsilon by which you find a vector non-trivially rotated. And it's like that in any dimension, yeah, just that in two and to some extent in three dimensions, it's still quite easy to visualize. So if I adopt a coordinate system for, like I did here, in one of the four simplices, say, where the beginning and the end point of my parallel transport lay, then this is kind of the rotation matrix associated with it. So this is a holonomy matrix. So in the three and four direction, nothing happens, and I find an SO2 direction in the perpendicular direction. Now, from the point of view of SO4, of course, it's a very special, it's just an SO2 subgroup. And just looking at it from the point of view, of the properties of that as a rotation group in four dimensions, it's not the generic SO4 rotation. And it's not even conjugate to the generic type of SO4 rotation you can have. The generic such rotation is what is called a double rotation, and it's characterized by basically two rotations around two independent axes. And it's therefore characterized not just by a single angle, but by a couple of angles, theta 1, theta 2, I've called them. Yeah? So for a general loop, it doesn't matter whether you happen to be in this piecewise flat context with the triangles or in the continuum. This is a general SO4 rotation you can write as being conjugate to kind of this basic form, yeah, block diagonal form characterized by two orthogonal SO2 transformation, depending on these two angles, where lambda is now some arbitrary SO4 matrix. Now, again, you ask yourself, so the invariant information that's in this is just given by these two angles. And this can be extracted upon taking the trace. So if that was the outcome of parallel transfer, the holonomy matrix, that's again just going from the holonomy matrix to what I call the Wilson loop by taking the trace. Yeah. So you can do two things. So there are two parameters that appear here, two angles, and there's still certain symmetry properties. Among them, the exchange of these two angles. And this you can't distinguish by the operations I'm now introducing. So I'm extracting information about these two angles by taking either the trace of a single copy of this holonomy matrix or running twice through the holonomy matrix and taking then the trace, and then subtracting some constant. And you see that up to some trivial reflection and exchange symmetries, I can extract these two angles just uniquely. Essentially uniquely from taking these two traces. And that will, of course, correspond exactly to Wilson loops. I mean, things that are no longer, these numbers are then no longer subject to any residual gauge transformations. So how do I do the concrete holonomy computations in CDT? Well, you make maximal use of the symmetries that are given to you. So the building blocks in four dimensions, they are equilateral four simplices. And one thing that maximally utilizes the symmetry is a coordinate system that you base at the barycenter of a simplex. So here I illustrated with the analogous example in two dimensions. And you have a bunch of d plus one basis vectors just from the barycenter to the edge. Yeah. And what I fix is the length of these guys, xi. They're all unit vectors. And, well, they all add up to zero. It can also be easily seen just from this two-dimensional example. Yeah. And their mutual scalar products, these are unit vectors again, are given by minus 1 over d. By d is now, d is now the dimension of the simplex. So that's a prescription of a coordinate system that works in any dimension and uniquely fixes my coordinate system. Yeah. So from this, I can compute the edge length, for example, in these equilateral building blocks. The reason why this is a minus sign here is because these angles are obtuse, yeah, between the various xi's based at the center. When I'm, so the only thing that this doesn't fix, the, what is the residual gauge freedom? It's the interchange of how I label the edges, the corners of the simplex. Yeah, here I have three labels, I mean three dimensions. So I call them 1, 2, 3, and here, therefore, I call these basis vectors x1, x2, x3. But of course, I could have done it in some different order. Yeah. So I have a symmetry, a relabeling symmetry. And in d equal to 4, the relabeling symmetry is a 5-factorial worth. Yeah, I have 120 different ways of choosing a coordinate system on a given simplex. Now, this is handy, this parametrization, also because when I do Monte Carlo simulations of CDT, these building blocks, the way they appear in the computer, is already through a labeling, among others, of these edges. So that's already there. Yeah. So the only thing I have to do is to work out, aha, I have a, you know, I have a building block with this edge labeling, then I have a neighboring building block with some other, vertex labeling corresponding to those. I have two Cartesian coordinate systems. The only thing I have to work out is what is the relative angle. So what is the transition matrix going from one to the next when I have a loop that just runs through, you know, a sequence of these objects? So what I do, there are finitely many ways of rotating this. Therefore, there are finitely many relative ways of orienting them. I put them in a big list. And whenever I hop from one to the next, I just look up in the list what the holonomy matrix was. I multiply them all together when I have a closed lattice loop. And whoops, I have my closed holonomy. I take the traces and I have Wilson loops. So my claim is that computing holonomies in 4D has never been easier. Yeah, I mean, if you're thinking of doing this in vector calculus, of course, then you still have to express all these quantities as functions of the edge lengths. So these are immensely complicated functionally. And then you have to do this computation, let alone computing holonomies in a four-dimensional, in an arbitrary four-dimensional curved manifold. Yeah. So that's not straightforward. What I'm saying here, this is very, very, very easy by comparison. OK, now I want to do something with these objects. Yeah, I want to measure them. Now, as I already said before, Wilson loops in themselves, in gravity, are not observables. They're only observed, well, they depend on one-dimensional curves in the space-time. And what I, well, these are not invariantly defined because I cannot, well, you know, I can either use a specific coordinate system to refer to where the loop is, but that's not an invariant definition. So, and the same problem you find if you now try to use these objects in a non-perturbative quantum context where there is a priori not even any background metric you could refer to say, aha, the loop goes from x equal to 1 to x equal to 3 and to describe where it is. So one has to try and find a way to mark, to either say where the loop is by marking it with something else, and that's a prescription we adopt here, or you have to characterize the loop in some other invariant way by describing, you know, its shape and how maybe it, well, how it's lying somehow in the manifold and try to, you know, then to sum over all such objects. So what you are doing is part of a general thing that you always have to do, namely translate objects that were well-defined and easy to write down and evaluate, say, in a quantum field theoretic context, to a context where you don't have a priori any background metric given, because the metric is part, is a dynamical variable of the theory. And this is one of the challenges we address in all approaches to non-perturbative quantum gravity. And of course, we have addressed it in specific ways already in CDT and successfully. And one of the examples I mentioned was the serialization group analysis we did recently. And you should be able to figure out who all of these people are, because they appeared on previous slides. This is Andreas Kreienbühl. He didn't appear on previous slides, but he also contributed. Just to illustrate for people who maybe haven't been exposed to this type of argument before, the issue in gravity is, let me rephrase the issue by looking at a standard object you'd evaluate in a quantum field theory, like a two-point function. So whatever theory you're looking at, could be some scalar field theory, yeah, you might look at the two-point function. It will depend on two points. Now, the problem is in a gravitational context where geometry is dynamical, this would not be a good observable a priori, because there's no way for us to point at what is a point X and what is a point Y. Yeah? You need a specific distinguished coordinate system to do that, and that you don't have in pure gravity. But we know of one way to fix it, certainly in this case, that is a prescription to say, to essentially to integrate over all possible points X and Y, but in order to make it into an interesting observable that depends on something, we let it depend on the mutual geodesic distance of X and Y. Yeah, and that depends, of course, on the metric. So this is kind of a diffeomorphism invariant way of constructing a two-point function in a context where gravity is dynamical. So this is a Euclidean expression, of course. So with the Wilson loops, in principle, it's exactly the same. But it's worse, because they don't just depend on a point X and Y. They depend on an entire curve. Yeah? So if you wanted to mimic a construction like that, you would have to characterize somehow the arrangement of these points along the curves in some way. Yeah? And that's not exactly straightforward, certainly not in four dimensions. But this is something you might want to do. So what do we do in order to make sense of our Wilson loops and to make them into genuine observables? We let the loop L, along which we take the Wilson loop, compute the loop, coincide with the world line of a particle. So we couple explicitly a massive particle to the Einstein-Hilbert action, which amounts to adding a piece to the action that's just the mass, the bare mass of the particle, times the length of the path. Yeah? This is integral dl. Once I triangulated things, it becomes very easy. It becomes m naught, so this is what I use for the bare mass, times just the number of links the path has. So it jumps, it moves between centers of adjacent triangular building blocks in such a fashion, as I illustrated here. Yeah? And I just count. I mean, how many links are there? And then I have the length. So what, of course, we usually do, and we also did here, we cyclically identify the time. So this line that went from the initial to the final surface in such a CDT geometry now becomes a closed loop that winds in a non-trivial way once around the time direction. Yeah? So what we do then, so this is now a dynamical system where gravity is coupled to the dynamics of a point particle. It distinguishes a line for me. And along this line, I then do the measurement of the Wilson loop. Yeah? So I take a line, I take the trace, and I take the trace of the squared. And that in that way, I extract two angles that are associated. So that gives me the invariant information associated with a Wilson loop. So the actual measurements were done for a time extension t equal to 80, so 80 time steps in the time direction in the space-time volume of 20,000 building blocks. So we measured these two trace invariants I introduced earlier, and from them extracted the angles theta 1 and theta 2. Well, that's not difficult, but the question is, what geometric arrangement should these two loops relate to each other?
Yeah,
for some time, and then us in the net escape theory just close in a spacious slice.
Yeah, then it's again the question of, of course, in lattice gauge theory, you know exactly what you mean by, you know, to keep them like running parallel at a distance r.
Some distance, which might seem of some things,
but they're not in a straightforward way
related to potential.
But it's not easy to implement them actually. Yeah. Let's talk about,
but this is one. One way of trying to creatively think about, you know, how on earth do we build meaningful, interesting observables from these?
Yes, perhaps. Okay. Let's discuss it, Jan. Let's discuss it.
I'm
coming close. I'm close to the end. So
what I want to do is one thing. So what I get now is a couple of angles, and that are characteristic for specific SO4 rotations. So I want to compare the distribution of these angles I find measuring, sampling Wilson loops along these particle trajectories and compare them with what I would expect theoretically if they were evenly distributed over the group manifold SO4, the points I'm sampling with my holonomy, okay? So that's just a theoretical computation that can be done quite straightforwardly. So one has to parameterize the SO4 group in such a way that these two angles are exactly coincide with what one extracts by taking these traces. But one needs four other angle variables to uniquely label all points on this six-dimensional group manifold. In this set of parameters, one computes the invariant Haar measure from the left or the right invariant forms by just taking a kind of bilinears. And then one finds actually a volume form that depends still on six variables. One integrates out four of them. And what one finds is a two-dimensional kind of the expected distribution of angles to appear with respect to Haar measure. So kind of the even if my holonomies were distributed evenly along the group manifold, then I would expect them to be to find a specific distribution. Here it's not normalized, but here I've normalized it. So here it's given totally explicitly. So it's the sine squared of the sum of the angles times the sine squared of the difference of the angles, essentially. So since we are measuring expectation values of theta 1 and theta 2, we can easily find now from our quantum simulations, also distribution and compare it to this one. And this is actually not normalized, so don't worry about the height of these. So what this shows is the actual measurements of the angles found here in ranges between 0 and 2 pi for both of these theta angles. So this is what we're measuring from the simulation, the Monte Carlo simulation. And it agrees extremely well with the theoretical kind of the even distribution which you would expect on the basis of the Haar measure if things were just evenly distributed. So this is what happens. Yeah, so we make all these measurements. And well, what we are reproducing is SO4. So what conclusion does this allow me to draw? Well, let me go back to the worries that I mentioned originally. So first of all, one could have been worried, well, we are in a coordinate-free approach. Can we compute these things? Can we make sense of them? And of course, the answer is yes. And not only that, it seems in this approach, computing holonomies is, as easy as can be, as simple as can be, but not simpler. So one could have been worried about large discretization effects. Yeah? But in a way, the fact that we are reproducing, kind of a densely, apparently, points along SO4 clearly shows that at least for this bunch of loops we are sampling here, we are not leaving out chunks of the group manifold. So, yet another consequence is, so the holonomy group of this quantum spacetime appears to be SO4. And that's, of course, the generic holonomy group for a four-dimensional Riemannian manifold. So this is the same here. Now, what it doesn't show, what one could have hoped one might have found here, is that somehow the Wilson loops, if one imagines that the geometry one is probing, maybe on large scales, resembles, in our case, some kind of de Sitter space, like we found from looking at, you know, the volume profiles, etc. One might have hoped that they cluster or they average out to be something, you know, close to the identity of the SO4. But this doesn't happen. So it's completely, you know, it fills out the SO4. So in that sense, we don't find, there's not much information, but we find the SO4, but there is no, we cannot, there's no way of writing it as unit matrix plus something that knows about curvature. Yeah. So that's clearly what we haven't achieved, certainly not with this setup and with the set of loops we have looked at here. So it's certainly a proof of principle that in a very rather straightforward way, these Wilson loops can be implemented and measured also here in the CDT formulation. But of course, the big challenge now remains to construct with these Wilson loops as ingredients, interesting observables which give us non-trivial information about quantum geometry of space-time, more specifically, some notion of average curvature. So the challenge is manifold. So in terms of the size of the loops, of course, you don't want them to be minimal, so the smallest possible loops, because then what you're picking up is just, you know, the way you've set up this discretization. You will just find these discrete deficit angles around individual hinges. So you want them to be somehow larger than this discretization scale, but not too large, so that you might be able maybe to assign with some, you know, analog of this formula, you know, 1 plus, you know, epsilon squared f, you know, some kind of average curvature information. So we haven't yet achieved that, but that's a challenge. And of course, well, it might fail. So one might not be able to find such observables, which or smeared out versions of these Wilson loop, which capture curvature information in the way one dreams of. Okay, that's where we are. Thank you.
One might have hoped, maybe you mentioned this, but one might have hoped that the distribution would be dependent on which phase you were in the phase diagram, or whether you were close to the critical line.
Well, we've done it only in the, you know, at one point in the phase diagram. So in the nice, in the interior of the de Sitter phase. So we haven't changed. We haven't done it.
You haven't said yet. So you're good to do that. No. Is the fact that your time variable is compactified, if this was a Euclidean path integral, then the compactified path time direction would correspond to a thermal distribution. So I'm not sure if you could make the interpretation.
The thermal distribution
of space times. When just using the whatchamacallit, the three letter correspondence that Euclidean path integrals with compactified time correspond to thermal expectation time.
In some of it, well, I don't think that applies here. I mean, I could have, well, of course, I needed to make it into a Wilson loop. I needed to close off things, but I could imagine, you know, also as Bianca was suggesting, you know, making big loops without them having a non-trivial winding number around the time direction. Or are you specifically after distinguishing what happens in the time direction as opposed to what happens in the space direction?
Yes, but since you do distinguish them.
Yeah. Well, we haven't...
You haven't said that. You haven't compared. You haven't done a loop in the compactified space.
No.
So it's...
Yeah.
So
of course... Yeah, yeah. So one can, of course, think of various ways of changing, you know, the reference, the set of loops one integrates over in a way. And one should then say, of course, compare them to some sort of expectation one has how these ought to behave, depending on how big they are. I don't have a specific expectation of how you know the Wilson lines would behave if I put them like that or like that.
You should see whether they're correlated. I mean, you know, how different they are, and how correlated they could be. Like one look like that and like that of the same length.
What would I compare it? What would I compare it to? What would my expectation be?
Where you want to see that you have Lorentz invariance or not?
But
so it should not whether you know you would see violation of Lorentz invariance or not. Whether a time-like loop or a space-like loop is of the same nature.
Well, but they don't yet have any, you know, there's nothing of the outcome that, you know, here I get just this SO4. And
I mean, you have two loops, like one vertical and one horizontal. Then you can compare. Yeah, you can put them both at the same time.
It's a completely different setup because here the loops are following the particle.
I mean,
it doesn't matter. You can put a particle, which is also, it's a video, so you can put a space-like particle.
But the whole problem is how do you put a path in a fluctuating geometry? So what do you mean by having a path there? Because you were changing the whole setup. Are you changing the path too? How do you fix it? How do
in the continuum you can answer that.
What
you're doing is that. I can show you that. In fact, what you're doing if you put a path there. What you're going to do is average over all paths of the given length. And that's an observable.
I would claim that it's not a very interesting observable.
No, for instance, if you want to see whether you break Lorentz invariance, that would be.
Well,
like,
there is no effective background metric in Hausdorff we have here.
Depends what you mean by interesting. It would give you some.
Well, you're clearly far away from any regime where the local geometry looks anything like
Minkowski or the sitter space. Yeah. So you're just seeing these. It just picks up these very strong curvature fluctuations.
It might also just give you a harm measure if you average over too much.
Yes, and then of course that would be disappointing.
You're looking after something that. You know, that, for example, or it correlates with certain parameters which you use to, say, characterize a certain subclass of loops. And, you know, you could imagine that you want to have some analog of, you know, circular loops, whatever that means in this fluctuating context, which are approximately planar, right? And then you could say, well, they have I can associate some radius with them, and then I could maybe study how, as a function of that radius, how my Wilson loop changes.
Yeah,
but it's very difficult.
Once you have a good continuum, they're going to be very important to characterize.
Not if I have a good continuum,
yeah.
But I would still need to find these characteristics, these geometric characteristics.
I know, but they're going to be very important to characterize whether you do have a good or not continuum. So for instance, it was a puzzle for 20 years in the QCD community. I don't know if you look at. So the QCD community, what they did is that they had these plaquettes, and they had the definition of the continuum limit, and some kind of second order phase transition. So everything was beautiful and nice. But for 20 years, there was a puzzle, which was that they looked at elementary plaquette. So they computed the expectation value of, like, it would be the smallest. Okay? And then they averaged over it. And, you know, the naive expectation was that in the continuum limit, which was achieved by other means, they would expect this expectation value to be 1. Right? The trace of the elementary Wilson loop in the continuum limit is a point, so the curvature goes to 0. And what they were finding is not 1, they were finding 0.2, 0.3, 0.5. They were finding something different from 1. And that was a deep puzzle. And in fact, it took them, I think, 20 or 30 years to realize that they had to do a very important fix in order to force these things to be 1. And once they force these things to be 1, then the precisions on their simulation improved by a factor. Suddenly, they were able to make prediction. This was the big technical game changer that happened 15 years ago in the game. So, you know, like naive expectations that the continuum limit on these observables is achieved is you know very important. I'm not saying here it's not the case.
Well,
but
I don't know how. Well,
I'm not too familiar with that example. I don't know how even to translate it as a matter of principle. Of course, here I have to take care really of this the necessity to do everything in a different way.
So, for instance, did you look at the elementary loops? Do they converge to 1?
And the Magnitude loops, I know exactly, they just depend on the coordination.
No, but do they converge to one? Let's say you take a loop that circles around one.
That doesn't make any sense.
No, it should make sense in the continuum limit.
No,
it should not.
There is one thing you can say
a priori what the result is.
Yeah, it should be one in the continuum limit.
Because the continuum limit is defined here differently, where you have to take into account for what you call an elementary loop many discretization things.
So 35 degrees.
It's a multiple times 2 pi over 6 or something. Yeah.
Then you can count the average coefficient. Yeah, but in the continuum limit, you should multiply this by some kind of scale. There should be a sense in which the local curvature.
That's why they look at Wilson loops, because it's hard.
There's an easy thing that if you want to check against a benchmark, you could do all this in the 2+1 dimensional case. And the 2+1 dimensional case, you could study loops with, say, an S3 or an S1 cross S2, which link differently and have different nodings or linkings. And we know the answer is related to the linking numbers and the topological invariants of the nodding.
Or even less
complicated things than correlators. I could just try and understand what curvature, how I have to renormalize the analogs of these Wilson loops to extract some curvature information in 2+1, because I know what it ought to be.
Right. But here, so I guess you have the same problem as QCD. If you don't find one for the elementary Wilson loop, it means you don't control yet the renormalization of these observables.
Yes, exactly.
So, and that's the basic problem. You want
exactly.
observables to...
What I pointed out on
to,
the first slide is that I need an effective way of come up with a meaningful notion of curvature. Exactly where I expect, of course, I have to have some physical input to understand how they get renormalized. Yes.
But the QCD people need them, because this is the problem.
We have a QCD expert. We have a QCD expert in the collaboration.
Okay. It took them 20 years to solve that.
Okay. I think you're misrepresenting this. I mean, they would have, before all this, they still found perfect scaling to matching of the strength tension to the continuum resolution.
Not for the
it was just a technical improvement. It was nothing fundamental.
It was a technical improvement that allowed them to make predictions.
Can I just ask the last question before we all have to go? Which is, in this case, if you also look at 3D, couldn't be that the behavior of the Wilson loop is kind of, or actually of the Wilson, of the parts of the Wilson loops are very different in, say, the regular universe, and then the part, because you complexify, which is the synth road, which you usually get. And it could be that in the synth road, you get much more randomized results, which, for instance, in 3D would not give you the answer you would like to get.
Did we isolate the... What the polynomials do in the stalk?
Yeah, that's
what you're saying.
Yeah, I mean, because the danger could be that it's basically just changing the results very much in this road. Because that's kind of the non-regular part.
Well, it's non-regular part, but also because we have the midpoint here, midpoint formulation, because it will, in the throat, I think, relatively speaking, the time it spends there will be less. So it will, it has much less way to go sideways somehow.
Yeah, no,
so I think the relative effect of that, I wouldn't expect to be very big.
Okay. No, if that's
something worth to check.
Yeah, if that's the case, it's fine. I mean, the danger is that it would be too average or too randomly changed.
But you mean it has a nice behavior? Well, again,
most of it is just coordinate effect, of course. If you talk about, holonomy from here to here, everything is in the coordinates. Only when once you close it off, it's an... Okay. Thank you.